This is the Penobscot Bay Report. I'm Ron Huber. On April 22, 2015, Maine State Representative Ralph Chapman spoke to the Environment and Natural Resources Committee on what his bill, LD 750, an act to allow regulated metal mining in Maine, would accomplish. Now, this date was the bill's first work session. Representative Chapman speaks for the people of Blue Hill, Brooklyn, Brooksville, Castine, Sedgwick, and Surrey. He sees the state's approach to mining law as sloppy, unscientific, putting too much at risk with too little response remediation assets in place. Chapman warned the committee was suffering from institutional ignorance of the effects of mining by relying on the committee's attorney to explain the impacts of mining. An attorney is not a scientist, he noted, just as a geologist would not be suited for pursuing cases in court. Does the department realize, he said, if there's metal mining, there'll be a minimum of 100 years of fluid storage and tailings pond left behind? Did they realize the average cost for a tailings storage facility failure is on the order of $500 million? Average, not the worst case. That's orders of magnitude beyond the department's thinking. It's not too late to consider the policy questions for which the full legislature seeks your guidance, he said. Take on the policy questions, not just the rulemaking. The recording is 30 minutes long.
Thank you for joining us. As the committee may recall, when Representative Chapman gave us his bill, we also asked him to give us some thoughts on what it was presently in rule and not, and he's here to share that with us. So, Ralph, you got a half hour if that'll work for you.
Thank you, Senator Saviello and Representative Welch and members of the Joint Standing Committee on Energy, Environment and Natural Resources.
This used to be the Energy and Natural Resources Committee way back in the day.
My name is Ralph Chapman. I represent House District 133 in Hancock County. And I have a variety of materials for you that I'll have your clerk give to you as we get to them. And, of course, I have more to say than time allows, so I apologize for the brevity of my comments on the specific areas. I am more than happy to go into more detail on any area that you choose. Give me a moment to... sort through the papers. Okay. I'd like to start by responding to the three questions that you asked of me at the time I presented LD 750, an act to allow regulated metal mining in Maine. The first question was to provide the complete context for a comment that I made regarding institutional ignorance shown by the Department of Environmental Protection. When they made the comment that the rejected resubmitted rules provided monies to cover a worst-case scenario. At the time that I made that comment during my presentation of LD 750, I was trying to communicate the need for this committee to access the needed expertise. And I wanted to highlight the state of ignorance, not only of the department, but of you and I as well. Consequently, I avoided naming the individual involved, but since you've asked for the detail, I've transcripted from the a video provided by that's publicly accessible on YouTube, prepared by Eric Tuttle. I transcripted the entire interchange, and it's a quotation of a question that Representative Tucker asked the Heather Parent, and I have that for you here. And I just read briefly. Representative Tucker asked, my question is, does the department anticipate that if there's metal mining, there will be a minimum of 100 years of fluids left? And to that question, she answered, we would not be approving a permit if we felt like there would be a minimum of 100 years of fluids left that needed to be treated. What the cost requirements refer to is if all of everything they are trying to do fails and there's a problem, what is the cost going to be to clean it up? And so we approve a permit only if they can demonstrate to our satisfaction there's not going to be a problem, but in the real world, problems happen on every site, on a typical site location of development site. And so we want to make sure that they've got the money and that they will provide us the money in the event something something happens. And so we're looking at a worst-case scenario for purposes of making sure that we have the assurance that they are going to give us the money to address it in the event of a worst-case scenario. And then Representative Tucker proceeded with a follow-up question. So that's the full context of my comment indicating institutional ignorance. And I just to fill out that a little bit to understand what I mean, as you know, the average cost for a tailings storage facility failure today in today's mining is on the order of $500 million. And so that's the average cost, not a worst-case cost. That's orders of magnitude beyond what the department had been thinking. And so I was trying to indicate that this is evidence of departmental ignorance. The second question that you asked me was to provide a citation for the 1997 publication that I referenced involving the mining industry study trying to find a mine that satisfied Wisconsin's prove it first law. And I've provided that to you here. And additionally, I'm providing your clerk with one copy of the version that's available online. I didn't make copies for everyone. Certainly, I would encourage you to read the report if you have not. Mining expert Robert Moran, in his email of March 9th, 2015, cautions readers to refer to the original paper cited and the piece of paper that you're getting from your clerk rather than the version that's online. Nevertheless, I've also given you a printout of the version that's online. The online version, Robert Moran calls a cleaned-up version. And this is an industry-sponsored study, and it takes a stance that's very favorable to the industry. At the same time, what's fascinating is, in spite of all of the wording that is very favorable to the industry, it does not actually identify any mine that meets the Wisconsin Prove It First law, and this was published in 1997. I don't have updated information for you. I think it would be useful if we had it.
I would agree. That was, I guess, the question was, where do we have the updated information? But what you have presently is just this citation, correct?
I cited the information that I provided to you. I don't have access to updated information. I would be very pleased to help you access it if there is such, if you would like me to do so. Then thirdly, the third question I was asked was to provide a side-by-side comparison to features of LD 750 with the resubmitted rejected rules developed in response to the 125th legislature, LD 1853. Now, during my presentation, I made it clear in the final short paragraph on page 4 of my testimony when I presented it that this committee ought not to engage in rulemaking. I recognize that the previous four work sessions have concentrated on pre-scheduled section-by-section review of the resubmitted rejected rules carried by LD 146 with the obvious effort of improving upon them by developing suggested changes to those rules. Although you've occasionally referred to provisions within LD 750, you've not yet begun a work session on that until today, which was intended to provide a statutory framework for the development of rules. So, in essence, you've asked me to compare a framework for development of rules with a set of rules, which is not in which there's not expected to be a correspondence, but you also asked that your analysts prepare the same thing, a side-by-side comparison. Before I get to that, let me point out that I hope that your work so far has been useful to you as a means to learn more about mining, and it's not too late to consider the policy questions for which the full legislature seeks your guidance. So I'm hoping that you will take on the policy questions rather than simply the rulemaking. As for a comparison of the rejected resubmitted rules and the provisions of LD 750, I'm going to give an example of the difficulty of the analysis that your analyst provided. And prior to doing that, let me explain that Your analyst is a lawyer and not a scientist, and although this will present his work in an unfavorable light, I want to hasten to add that I fully expect that if scientists were to provide a legal analysis, they would do as poor a job at that. And so I'm not trying to be critical of any person or their effort. So I pick one example. From LD-750, and I'm quoting now from the materials that your analyst prepared from you, rules must require that all mining areas be left in or returned to a geologically stable condition following remediation and closure. That provision of LD-750 then compared with rules, and he picked out four rules, 11A-2B, 20C-1AI, 23C, and 24A-3AI. I'm going to go through those briefly. I'll give you the quick excerpt from his notes and then give you my comment in one or two sentences. 11A2B, mining operation is located on soil and right rock types and geological structures that are suitable to the nature of the mining operation. There simply is no correspondence between the LD-750 and this rule other than that both use the word geological. Mining operations located on geological structures suitable for mining says nothing about leaving the area in a geologically stable state. 20C1AI, all excavated and reclaimed areas must be designed, constructed, and stabilized to withstand natural geological processes, climatic conditions without failure that would be a threat to public safety and the environment. This rule is under erosion control to prevent, quote, unacceptable settling, subsidence, voids, caving, or slope failures, unquote. It has nothing to do with long-term chemical stability. 23C, permittee shall reclaim the mining areas and affected area to the ecological conditions that approximate pre-mining conditions. The only correspondence between LD-750 and this rule is that the words geological and ecological rhyme. 24A3AI, closure design must be based on the following factors, the geology and geologic setting of the unit. The geology and geologic setting of the unit as a factor says nothing about requiring geologic stability. There is no connection between LD-750 and this rule other than that both use some form of the word geologic. So the point that I want to make here is I've picked out one of the important features of LD-750. It was one of the provisions that your analyst put side by side with existing rules, and it came up with four potential rules that might have had something to do with that provision of LD-750. In two cases, it was the same form of, it was some form of the word geologic. In one case, it was a rhyming word, and in another case, there was a phrase, and there are actually two words in a phrase that was that corresponded, but there was absolutely no meaning that corresponded. So I'm have to simply state that the department's contention that the elements in LD-750 are encompassed by the rules is patently false.
That's your opinion.
I have to say that again. No, I'm presenting this, but I'm presenting this as a factual statement. And I'm using your analyst's analysis of one of the important provisions of 750 to illustrate that fact, that the rules do not encompass the provisions of LD-750. They simply don't. This is one important provision of LD-750, and the best that we come up with is some rhyming words. I'm sorry, it does not correspond. Now, I'd rather get on, now that I've answered those three questions that you asked me, I'd rather get on to what I think is a more important use of our time at the present time, which is to look and see what it is that I would have preferred that this committee undertake in the dozens of hours of its work sessions, and that is the policy questions. So for your aid, I've listed some policy questions in kind of an order just to frame it. And I want to restate that I think that a real function, a useful function your committee can provide is providing recommendations to the full legislature on policy. And the policies questions, you know, the first one, shall Maine allow mining? And by implication of what we've all done, the answer there is yes. The second question, shall mining in Maine be regulated? Certainly, LD 750 suggests it should, and your attention to the rules suggests it should. Question number three, what aspects of mining need regulation? And you've discussed this some, things like water quality, air quality, risk, financial liability, for examples. What question four, what overriding standards should be applied to those areas needing regulation? For example, for water quality, contamination levels, types of water, location relative to the site, for air quality, similar matters regarding types, particulate sizes, transport controls. For risk, what's the risk of catastrophic failure? What's the risk of out-of-compliance failure? These would be policy, matters of policy. In terms of financial liability, what is the amount of financial liability that's covered? What's the financial risk to the taxpayers? These are matters of policy. So that gets to question number five, what risks are acceptable? Now, we all have varying individual opinions on the acceptability of risks in many aspects of our lives. As a society, we also have opinions that are expressed through our governmental, statutory, and regulatory processes, and that is what we're getting at right here. Mining represents risks to human health and the environment, which is the reason for regulating it in the first place, and that's why the answer to question number two, shall mining in Maine be regulated, I think is an affirmative answer in most of our minds, if not all of our minds, is because there are risks involved, and we want to we want to minimize those risks as much as practicable, but you have to understand that when the rules say minimize as much as practicably possible, as much as is reasonably practicable, that says nothing. To minimize a risk as reasonably practicable is not an actionable, definable degree of risk. It would be helpful to define the risk. So, for example, what probability of mine out-of-compliance failure does the committee believe is acceptable? 90%, 50%, 10%, 1%? The 1997 study could not find a mine that was not out of compliance with the Wisconsin criteria, for example. That doesn't mean that we expect all mines to be in compliance. But what level does the committee believe is an acceptable risk of out of compliance in order to obtain the benefits? Now, the benefits might well be stated as well. Why allow mining, presumably to achieve some benefit? But I'll come back to that. What probability of mine catastrophic failure does the committee believe is acceptable? 10%, 1%, 0.1%, 0.001%? What probability of the public incurring expense for a mining operation does the committee believe is acceptable? 10%, 1%, 0.1%, 0.001%? Okay, so we pick a number to define a goal, a policy goal. Or there are other questions. My question number six, what processes are too high risk to allow? LD 750 names some of them, in situ leaching, heap leaching, block caving, etc. Question number seven, what deposits are too high risk to allow being mined? Which deposits is the sulfur content too high or the NPAP ratio too low? And then, importantly, question A, how is the high risk for a deposit defined? In other words, if the committee says, okay, we want to allow mining, we want it regulated, we want to minimize the risks, and we set a risk level that we think is appropriate, and we do not want to mine a high-risk mine, we only want to mine low-risk, a high-risk deposit, we only want to mine low-risk deposits, Then we have to define what is a high-risk deposit. Now, a high-risk deposit might be defined as a deposit of 2% or greater sulfur content, or an NPAP ratio that's 10 or less. That might be the definition of a high-risk deposit. Now, are the numbers that I have provided in that last sentence the right numbers to use? Well, obviously there's an opinion matter that comes into play, but there's also, do those numbers correspond to the answer to the question about the acceptable risk? If the acceptable risk for a catastrophic failure that this committee thinks is appropriate is, for example, 0.1%, then does defining the high risk level of a mine deposit correspond to achieving that risk level? Now, this is where I'm trying to make the point that this is where it would be very useful if the committee were able to access the scientific expertise that's needed to help you evaluate that. So the fundamental matter I want to impress upon the committee is that proceeding from policy goals to framework legislation to rulemaking is the way good public policy can be developed. And as can be seen from the above example, to do so requires access to expertise in the matter of the policy concern. Let me just give an example of what the committee might say. For example, we want to allow metal mining in Maine to achieve certain benefits, and it would be helpful if we stated what those were so that those could be evaluated in conjunction with the acceptable risk levels. We want the risk to human health and the environment to be less than 0.1% or per year or whatever, the number you choose. We want the risk of financial liability to the public to be less than 0.01% or again, whatever number you think is appropriate. We want to disallow mining a high-risk mine, defining high risk. We want to disallow the use of high-risk processes with definition of those processes. And we want to disallow use of unproven technologies, again, with definition. This would be an example of setting the policy goals. Unfortunately, the committee does not have the resources to bring the mining expertise before it to provide expert analysis of these matters under discussion. Although I have brought several relevant subjects to the table through LD 750, and I'm pleased to have been able to do so, I do not have expertise in mining. The numbers that I have suggested represent my level of understanding of what a high-risk mine deposit is, but I don't declare that those numbers represent what industry experts would find to be appropriate numbers. Perhaps it is now clear to the committee that the processes of policy goal setting, framework legislating, and rulemaking when dealing with matters of significant technological complexity is fraught with difficulties. I'm sure you're aware of that. I'm sorry that we have not been able yet to find a mechanism to bring scientific expertise to bear on the policy formation questions of importance to the matter of mining. Now, I want to close with two comments on two specific matters. The liability limits on my automobile insurance is a typical amount of $300,000. The average liability claim for an automobile accident is $15,000. I'm insured for 20 times the average. Although it is possible that I would be responsible for an accident worse than the one resulting in a $300,000 claim, we could, for the sake of argument, call this a worst-case scenario. The average cost of a tailing storage facility failure is $500 million. By applying the same ratio of average to worst cases in the auto insurance example, a worst case TSF failure would be $10 billion. I've heard this committee refer to $10 million for insurance. Applying the same ratio to my auto insurance would suggest that I purchase only $300 of liability insurance for my automobile. I'm just trying to point out that there are orders of magnitude disconnects in the conversation that we've been having. Comments have been made about anomalously high levels of background metal concentration in some waters in Aroostook County. If my understanding is correct, the likely cause of the displacement by glaciation, the likely cause of these of the higher background concentrations in some water is likely caused by the displacement by glaciation a few tens of thousands of years ago of parts of the volcanogenic massive sulfide deposit at Bald Mountain. The glaciers during the last ice age scraped and moved parts of the deposit, which are now weathering and slowly dissolving. It was the understanding that the present locations of these pieces were the result of glacier movement that allowed for the discovery of the Bald Mountain deposit in the first place. We are seeing in the high background levels the effects of the weathering that has taken place over the last 10,000 years. The glacier did not pulverize the entire deposit, as a mining operation would do, which would vastly increase the reactive surface area, nor did the glacier design for leaving the moved pieces in a geologically stable condition. I tell this story to accentuate the importance of thinking long-term about geologic stability. We're seeing the effects from some tens of thousands of years ago of a disturbance in what had been sealed from weathering activity for hundreds of millions of years due to the glaciation. Finally, this is neither the first nor the last legislative committee that has or will confront technologically challenging issues of public policy formation. I thank you for giving it a try, and I am more than happy to expand upon any element of what I've discussed. I have left a great deal out of my brief presentation to fit your intended time schedule. Thank you. I'm happy to answer your questions.
Questions? Dan, one thing we could do is, if you would, or Tyler, the citation that he gave us, if you email that to the committee so they can look it up themselves. Yeah. No questions? Ralph?
Yes.
Represent Tucker.
I'm not going to the core of your remarks, but to the interesting fact that you've put out there about the glacier.
Yes.
And you seem to be turning around the argument about the fact that there's already arsenic and acidity and so forth already. I mean, we've heard that raised in the committee that, well, it's already polluted, you know, it's already a risky area.
Yes.
So you're saying that what exists there is just because the glacier scraped off a part of this deposit, and look what that left. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying.
You're trying to turn the argument around on us here?
I'm using this. I'm not making an argument. I'm bringing a thought process to bear to recognize that, and I do not know how much of what the arsenic levels are in the water and so forth is due to the glacier having moved a piece of the deposit, what level is due to the hundreds of holes that have been drilled into the deposit, or what is due to things that are unrelated to this deposit or what the glacier has done. I'm not an expert in that. What I'm suggesting, though, is that I am aware that the glacier did move pieces of this deposit. That's how the deposit was found. I am aware that there are higher levels in the water. And so what I'm trying to suggest is that over the last 10,000 years, because of the disturbance that happened some tens of thousands of years prior to that during the Ice Age, we're seeing the effect of that. Which is to say, if we are going to dig into one of these deposits and we do not leave it in a geologically stable condition, one can expect for the next 10,000 years it will be our activity will be visible as well. And that is the reason why I picked in LD 750 the value of 1,000 years to be somewhere in the right ballpark for consideration as to how stable a geologically stable condition deposit should be left. I guess I'm also saying that geological processes today are forming new volcanogenic massive sulfide deposits. There are areas on the surface of the earth where concentrations of those deposits are higher and places where they're lower. our job, in my opinion, is the protection of the environment that we have, not to look for making it worse.
My last question is, do you have a handout for the 8 points you made?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I do. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you, Ralph.
I'm sorry, Bob. Thank you. As you know, we're going to use 750 as the conduit for it, and we'll schedule another public hearing on it for, we're asking permission for either May 4th or May 6th.
May 6th or 11th.
May 4th or 11th. Yes, that's right. May 4th or 11th.
And okay. I hope you're able to include in it the policy recommendations rather than simply a refinement to rules. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now there was one other thing I want to do before we go into 1244.
Thank you, Ralph.
Yeah, Ralph, thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time to answer our questions. It's much appreciated. And as I said, I've asked for an article to be sent out to everybody.
You're speaking of the article that
I just gave a citation for
the web.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the web version of that's correct.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. Do you have a copy of the real version?
I do not have a copy of the original. Okay. I have the citation for the original, and I have a copy of the web revised, so-called cleaned up version.
I would assume it got edited or got shortened for the web, but